Welcome to another episode of Thinking Like a Bank, where we show you how to think like a bank by applying the same strategies and principles that banks use to help you find more financial freedom in your life. I'm your host, Sari Ibrahim. Today, I'm interviewing Jason Yarousi. He's the founder of Yarousi Holdings with his wife, Peely. They have acquired $180 million in real estate across 1,900 multifamily units since 2017. He's an avid ultra runner and workout enthusiast. He hosts a podcast called Multifamily Life Podcast and Seven-Figure Multifamily Mastermind. Jason wakes up daily at 4:32 a.m. And most importantly, he's a father of three amazing kids. Jason, welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to interview you, get to know you a little bit more today. I know it's probably going to be about real estate, but before we jump into real estate, do you mind sharing with us more about your background and who you are?
Sure. So I grew up in New Jersey. I'm now in Tennessee. In New Jersey, after college, I actually went into a couple of different, forms of business. I started working as a bartender, which led into opening restaurants and bars in New York City. I opened and sold a brewery. And then that led into the early 2010s. Hurricane Sandy happened just caused a lot of devastation on the East Coast. And my dad has a small construction company that's targeted to heavy construction, for which they lift and move homes. He's done that for about four decades now. Well, his business went from a couple jobs a year, being a very niche business, yep, to 1,000 calls a day. Wow. So my brother working for me, my girlfriend at the time, who's my wife now, Peely, and myself picked up and basically just moved out of what we were currently doing to go help dad really just continue his path with his business, right? That was great. It gave us a ton of opportunity to help dad and also just be exposed to a lot of different projects and a lot of different very unique situations. So we helped a lot of homeowners, doing about 300 projects a year. And what was the common through line is that we've constantly been in the service business, the service being that you have to do, right? So if we didn't go to work, there's no revenue, especially in a niche business, it's hard to outsource any of that. So we were constantly driven by having to do. And so we were constantly looking for ways of how can we find a way to get back our day? How can we find a way to get back our time? Because at that moment, if we could work, say 8 days a week, 25 hours in a day, we could have used it because that's how busy we were. Mm-hmm. And what constantly continued to come to the table was real estate. And that word is a very big word because it can mean a million different things to a million different people. And what we thought it was at first is Peely, who is now my wife, but pregnant at the time, goes out, gets a real estate license, and we start finding homes and flipping homes and doing these very elaborate flip projects. Lo and behold, we found out was very active because now we're busy with the construction, still helping dad. And here we are doing all these very intensive rehab projects. That led into doing wholesaling, doing Airbnb projects, doing short rent was out of state. When finally everything aligned, when we came upon a podcast just like this talking about investing in large multifamily. And that was that aha moment where we understood how we could use the powers of finding great opportunities, providing great value, putting together a proper process of really where you could just find a business that was underperforming and improve it and do this all in a systematic way where you could empower other people to help all benefit from this opportunity. So we sold everything off that we were doing, all the small rentals, mm-hmm, moved away from the flipping. At that time, we had helped dad and we were moving into another phase. And that led us in about 2016 into buying apartment buildings. And we now, since then, our first purchase was a 93-unit apartment building in Louisville, Kentucky, back in 2017. And we've now purchased probably a little over 2,000 units in about six states, mainly in the Southeast. And we're now down here just south of Nashville, Tennessee.
Now, Jason, I think a lot of people in your situation, like you're buying your first property, right? 93 unit. A lot of people would think like, I'll never in my life be able to buy a 93 unit building. What gave you the thinking, the thought process of, you know what, this is possible?
You know, when you empower yourself with knowledge, right, and you find that from other people, from us, it was just making connections. So, we started our own podcast, and that podcast allows other people. When you see proof case, right, it gets back to the 4 minute mile. Roger Bannister, no one ever run a 4 minute mile. The doctor said you would die, your heart would explode, and then lo and behold, Roger Bannister does it 1 year, right? Yeah. 60 something, 70 years ago, and I think that year 200 people did it. Was it that people just got magically faster? And just no, it was that people saw it happen. And when they saw it happen, they understood it could be accomplished. So as we started to surround ourselves with more people doing this, it made more sense why they were doing it. Because if you think even today, Say you buy a single family house and you assume that's safer, right? Because a 93 unit building or a single family home, I'll do the single family home because that would be safer for me. Well, you have one tenant. So either you're 100% occupied or 0% occupied. Yeah. The 100 unit building or 93, to say 100 unit building for easy math. Okay, one tenant's out. Now you have 99 other tenants who can pay down your mortgage. 99 other tenants that can pay their rent, pay the expenses, and give you other opportunities within cash flow. So who's safer, right? From a bank perspective, is it's the larger property because there's more opportunities for that property to succeed. Because if that one tenant either doesn't show up or goes and say, just decides not to pay rent and you're into a state that's not friendly for landlords and just stays there for 10 months, then it comes back to you as the person now having to cover that mortgage. So the bank's going to look harder on that one because it's going to be more crucial about who you are, right? So the larger the building, the more leverage you can have and the things you can do can accomplish a lot more. So for instance, in that first 93 unit, we went in there and changed all the toilets out, right? Mm-hmm. But a single family home on a flip, if you change a toilet out, you know, no one's really going to say, oh, you changed that toilet. I'm going to give you, you know, tens of thousands of dollars more on the property. Yeah. But changing the toilets out in that property lowered the water bill, along with us helping tenants to reduce any of the, you know, the leaks they had or anything else. We reduced our water bill by about 30%. Wow. Based on the cap rate, which one of the valuation tools on apartment buildings at the time, that building became worth over $300,000 more just by changing toilets. So if you think about some of the small leverage plays you can make on larger opportunities, it again gives you more power to understand why it can be an easier play to go after a larger opportunity as long as you can go into your mindset. Right? Because that's the first thing that usually comes up today. You know, we have a mastermind with about 75 businesses in it. And in that mastermind, the thought is, well, should I start with a 4 unit before I do the 20 unit, before I do the 100 unit? Well, if your mind needs it, sure. Right? But again, it's not like, hey, I need to learn to ride a bike. Well, I don't need to go swim first. Right? Yeah. You pick the one you want to do that your mind's ready for. And so at that time, we had done some 2 and 3 unit properties, and we understood that, you know, going from a 20, a 2 or 3 to a 20 to 100, it's the same steps.
Yeah.
But the bigger we get, the more opportunity, the more diversification, the more ability to utilize all the different things that make multifamily great, from cash flow, appreciation benefits, whether it's forced or by nature, depreciation, tax advantages, debt pay down, all afforded by apartment buildings. Larger they get, the more opportunities they are, and the more sophisticated of an end buyer you will have in the future as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's advantageous from the general partner standpoint, the active partner, right? And the limited partners, right? Because when you buy a 93 unit, you can bring in outside investors. If you're buying a single family, it doesn't really make sense to bring in outside investors to one property. So can you talk more about the benefits of being a limited partner in this case?
Sure. So as you spoke, we bring in limited partners, which are passive investors. So these investors are solely responsible for bringing in funds to help fund the down payment alongside the money we put in, the repairs we'll make in the building, any of the reserves, any of the fees that are associated with the building. And the reason this is because the larger pool of capital, we can buy these large buildings. And because they're larger buildings with more cash flow opportunities, they provide more economies of scale, which everyone can benefit from. So these investors can come invest for a number of different reasons. Maybe they're investing because they want to increase their monthly passive cash flow or passive income, right? Maybe they're investing because they want to get depreciation benefits or build their balance sheet, right? So there's a lot of different reasons, some of which people will invest for one reason, some for another, some for all of them combined, depending on what really is their strategy and where they are in their investment purposes.
That makes sense. And what's like your, I know you're involved in multifamily. What's your opinion compared to other asset classes?
So other asset classes can benefit in different times. The thing that makes, of course, multifamily one of the most attractive asset classes, because they say real estate's a hedge, right? Yeah. But real estate's a hedge, but some are better hedge plays. And when you look at multifamily, right now, we're seeing a lot of people being priced out from being able to afford a home, right? So someone who could afford a home just a year ago now can afford a home that's about 40% less. Well, a year ago, there was no homes for that person to get into, right? So 20 people trying to buy the same home, which one get, 19 can't. And now the homes for the home they could find before where prices have not reduced, you know, 40, 50% is not available. So they're going to be pushed to rent and rent for longer, right? So it's going to make that a bigger push on rental rates, which is going to push more into our properties being, of course, worth more. For another reason here, when you look at multifamily properties, you know, we need something, I think it's 16 million units built this decade. We're going to build about 11 million, right? So again, we're going to be within a deficit of housing. We haven't actually caught up with the amount of houses needed to be built per year since all the way back since 2007, 2008. All developers got burned, right? Yeah. Very hard. They were, we'll say shy to pull the trigger now for all these years. We're starting to come back and now everything starts costing a lot more. It's harder to get things in the ground. And with all the restrictive covenants and all the things that happen from a government perspective, it's just harder to get projects started and they cost more. So we can't keep up with housing. It costs more to build. We need more housing. So what that means is the housing we already have, the multifamily buildings we have, the reason that they're a good inflation play is because they're ultimately now costing and worth more because to replace them, it would cost more to build them more today. So now our rental rates are going up. They're worth more because there's not a lot of them to go around, right? Enough to meet all the need. And if you were to build it, it would cost so much more today compared to where it was just, you know, decades before. So it gives you a very good approach for why multifamily real estate is recession proof in its own time. Yeah. Right. You look at even COVID, all these other things that have happened. We haven't had, I think there was one dip in BC housing, so very workforce housing in rental rates. And that was back in 2007, where I think it dipped like 2%. Beyond that, you haven't seen a dip in rental rates. And even with the driver, they're saying, you know, rents are now decreasing. It's not so much that they're decreasing, they're just not increasing at the same rate that they were for the last 2 years when they were really increasing at an unsustainable rate. Right. You know, people can't afford it. If you start increasing rental rates 20-30% every year, it prices everybody out, regardless of where you are.
Yeah, definitely. And my next question was going to be the increase, like, has the increase in interest rates affected multifamily? But it sounds like it really hasn't because the demand has also gone up lately.
It always is a moving trigger, right? Yeah. So you have to see with banks. Banks are always going to be uncertain and stand back from lending until they can get used to the uncertainty, right? So in COVID, everybody stopped, everybody penciled down, nobody was lending here for a couple months, but they kind of figured things out. And then when it became like the new normal, as you want to call it right now, then they go back to lending, right? Because now they have banks make money by putting money out, but not by just hanging out, thinking about it, right? Yeah. So they want to get out there and lend money, but they don't want to be exposed. So as soon as they get used to the uncertainty, it'll go back out there. So right now, the big thing, right? So when you say think like a bank is that, well, banks, different banks do different things. Right. So a hammer is not the same as a screwdriver. Yeah. So, you know, a regional bank is different from a local bank, which is different from a national bank, which is different from a bridge lender or a hard money lender, which, you know, is different from a credit union. They're all going to have different plugs in place and they're all going to have different lending parameters that are going to be tied to different things, right? So there'll be certain lenders, say local or community banks, that are just lending off their balance sheet. So they're going to be more easier potentially, right? But then their terms might be like, so they'll be easier just on the lending because they can make choices in-house, right? But then their terms might not be as attractive. Maybe it's a 20-year amortization. Maybe it's a 5-year term. Maybe it's recourse where you can go to a larger player like a Fannie or a Freddie or a bridge lender where they're going to be tied to the treasury rate or going to be tied to SOFR, but they'll give you 30 years amortization. Maybe they'll give you 5 years of interest only, right? So depending on the lender, there's going to be different levers that are going to pull where some will be in your favor and some will not based on where you are in different market dynamics.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I see that. Yeah, definitely. There's so many different types of lending and when you have it that way. And speaking of the different types of lending, when you have the limited partners, there's different ways that the limited partners can access their equity, right? The way they come up with capital. Do you mind sharing some of the common ways that limited partners come up with money to put into these deals?
Yeah, very, very good. Very good question. So we have investors who will invest in a number of different capacities based on what's going to be beneficial from them and how they want to invest, right? It could be just them individually, just as a cash investor. It could be them through their business, through an LLC, through a 401k or self-directed 401k or IRA, where people invest through a trust. You can also invest 1031 money. So there's a lot of different opportunities for them to invest. Right. Mm-hmm. And so different opportunities will warrant different investments. So some people build up a lot of money in an IRA. The IRA is allowed to be rolled over, and they've just been getting killed in the stock market or just somewhere where it just hasn't moved for 20 years. My aunt being one, she worked at a bank for a number of years, and her IRA just never did anything. It's just money sitting there dying, right? So she rolled over to a self-direct IRA. We've she's now invested with us. We've actually, I think she's invested in four opportunities that have all sold and produced more on one opportunity than she did in just 20 years of being with the bank, right? So if you look at that, if you can find good people to invest with, have good relationships, you can utilize them in different ways, right? So the cash investor, a person who just invests with their own funds, are going to get the benefit of cash flow, right? Are going to get the benefit of depreciation, a number of different opportunities here. The IRA is really just going to get the cash flow, but they're going to have more tax advantages, but they won't get the depreciation benefits. So depending on you and your investment culture and what's going to fit your needs, you can invest into a multifamily investment or a syndication or really just real estate in general, depending on how you're looking to invest, what's going to benefit you the most. You can use a lot of different levers to invest.
Yeah. And even like whole life insurance, right? Could be one of them, like using the infinite banking system and using cash value whole life insurance.
Yeah, infinite banking is a really interesting thing because you can take, usually infinite banking, what happens here is that you'll set up a program that's going to be cash driven, right? Because hopefully you're a healthy person. So it's going to take an effect that you're going to have a lower death benefit today because there's going to be a more push forward on the cash value of the policy. So the more money you put into it, and there's certain things that I can't talk to here, but just because I don't know enough to the policy, but they maximize the policy to benefit you from a cash value standpoint in the front side. So you put more money up front. But what that allows you to do is that the money will sit there and typically it's going to get a dividend. Now, nothing's ever guaranteed, but these life insurance companies have produced dividends for decades, hundreds of years, right? They haven't missed a dividend. So you're getting that. And what happens is your money goes into a pool. But in the same time, what you can do is you can take loans against your infinite banking policy, right? Now, these loans are not you actually taking your money out of the policy. Yeah. So your money stays there working in the policy, getting the dividends, getting the return every year, basing your money in there. And what you're doing is you're taking a loan from the pool of money. So again, if you had, you know, $500,000 of available money based on the cash value you build up there, you're not, and you take $100,000 out, you're not actually reducing that to $400,000. It stays $500,000 in there. And what you're doing is you're taking $100,000 and getting it loaned from a pool of money with a number of different lenders would do that, right? Now, you're usually paying prime. So, you know, prime today is 625, you're paying, or 650, right? You're paying 6.5% of that money. But if you feel that you can get into opportunities for where now you have the money working, that's sitting there still with the life insurance company, right? Now you also take that money out and say for that money, you can make 10%, 12%. Well, now you're using an arbitrage play where you're making the delta here, right? Yes. So you're paying 6.5, you're making 12, well, you're now making that arbitrage of 5.5 on top of what you're making in the policy. So it's a really attractive play to be able to go out there and use funds in a way. And that's when they call it infinite banking. Yeah. Right. Because you're basically becoming your own bank. So instead of going there to say, hey, you know, I'm going to go buy a car and get a loan on it. Well, now you can use infinite banking or something else to accomplish that model and control the narrative.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, definitely. I use the same thing for real estate investing as a limited partner. Yeah. And it's really good because you can always find the liquidity. It keeps growing. You can use the dividends and the rental income that you receive from these properties to go put back into the policy. And then kind of repeat that process and find more deals. And yeah, definitely, I think it's a very efficient way of using capital. How can listeners like learn more about these kinds of strategies and like what podcasts you recommend, what books you recommend?
Sure. So if you want to learn more about us, you can go over to Urusi Holdings. We have our Multifamily Live podcast. We talk a lot about multifamily, right? So if you want to go there, we'd love to have you come listen in. We touch on a lot of topics, all talking to the market here, the real estate market, the economic market, and multifamily, right? So that's a bigger part for us. If you want to learn, I mean, there's a ton of great podcasts out there that just give you a good sentiment of the market. I think it was Robinhood Snacks. Now it's I forget what it's called today, but the Best Ever Show, right? That's a good one out there. That's a good talking point. Pull it up real quick. The Real Estate Special Show is a good one from that point. The Crypto Podcast Network, because they have a lot of economic sentiment podcasts, which are really targeted as well. It's just good because remember, news serves as a point. It's one to hopefully educate us, but a lot of times it's opinionated, right? Yes. So you have to make sure to see other different aspects here so you can get the through line of why things are happening, right? Because sometimes they say, you know, in chess that the threat of the move is more powerful than the move itself. Right. And so you'll see a lot of things, even like the Fed, when they're talking about, you know, if you see Jerome Powell come out and he's saying things, is that we don't know what he's going to do. But sometimes the emphasis of the words he's trying to put on is trying to make an impact before the move is actually happening. Right. So we have to constantly have our head around what's happening out there, because we don't think about inflation. We don't think about a lot of these things in the world until they're in front of us all the time. Right. So, you know, 5 years ago, or, you know, 4 years ago, no one's talking about like the price of bread, right? Or out there, like, you know, like it's just one of these things that like all of a sudden now it's in front of us everywhere. So it's a big deal. We're all focusing on inflation and rate hikes. Like nobody, if you tell me like who's paying attention to the rate hikes, you know, like, or to where SOFR was or where LIBOR was, you know, like 3 years ago, like not many people are paying attention to that now, but now everybody's hearing about rate hikes. Right. Yeah. So you have to think in different phases that, to be in this, you want to be exposed to be knowledgeable enough to understand the economic triggers and really the other financial triggers, or really just the world triggers that are moving the narrative in a lot of these spaces, right? Yeah. It's going to continue. So as we look forward here, there's been a lot of interesting things, right? From COVID to war to, you know, just inflation. There's just been so many different pulls on us on all sides that it's going to be interesting to see how we continue to adapt.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Jason, it was a pleasure having you on the podcast. I'll put the links you mentioned in the show notes below so that way listeners can connect with you and learn more about you. And I'm looking forward to bringing you back on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
To learn more about what we do and how we can help you grow more wealth, please visit www.finassetprotection.com. That's F-I-N, assetprotection.com. The topics presented in this podcast are for general information only and not for the purposes of providing legal, accounting, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult a professional who knows your specific situation.